And welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. This is Colin Miller, one of your hosts on the Undisclosed podcast. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Rabia Chaudhry. Rabia, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you doing, Colin?
I'm doing great. And so we will discuss all things episode 8 of The State versus Patricia Roar. But first, Rabia, I wanted to bring something to your attention. It is something our listeners brought to my attention. This is in New Jersey in a case, State versus French Lee. Mr. Lee was convicted of 2 counts of burglary. The only evidence that linked him to the crime scene was latent fingerprint analysis. And so the state Supreme Court in New Jersey just ordered a full hearing on the reliability of fingerprint comparison. They cited to the 2009 National Academy of Sciences report and the 2016 report of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. And so, you know, Robbie, we just discussed recently the difference between hair comparison versus bite mark. And in that PCAST report, they discuss not only faulty hair comparison, which is a huge part of Patty's case, not only bite mark analysis, but yeah, as the New Jersey Supreme Court noted, they discuss the flaws with fingerprint analysis. And it's not the fingerprints themselves, it's the examiners who lack the training. And then Robbie had to set up sort of the back end of our season, they found issues with DNA testing. And they said it's not the DNA itself, although the probability that two samples from two different sources have the same DNA is tiny, the chance of human error is much higher. Such errors may stem from sample mix-ups, contamination, incorrect interpretation, and errors in reporting. And so, Robbie, I love that New Jersey is looking over this. What are your thoughts about New Jersey saying, this old gold standard of fingerprinting, we need to go back and reassess that?
I mean, it's about time. I mean, this has been the frustration all along. I mean, these reports, you know, about like the issues with this kinds of forensic evidence, it's been around for over a decade. We've known this for a long time, 10, 15 years, right? And the question has been, how do we implement this in the legal system to either undo things or even stop allowing it to be presented now as evidence? Because it is continued to be presented as sound evidence. And in front of a jury of folks who might not know, and even judges who don't have the training, frankly, you know, it's just continued to be accepted and admitted as evidence. So I think this is fantastic. I'm kind of surprised, also, you know, not just on the fingerprint stuff, and but even on the DNA stuff, because it just feels like DNA is so like it's just considered like gospel, right? But finally, the fact that courts are recognizing the aspect of human error. I mean, there are cases where, like in very clear instances where like there's been contamination or there's been some kind of a sample mix up or something has happened, but it's the recognition of human error that I think is exciting to me, that courts are finally seeing that that is also something that has to be taken into consideration.
And this is the second critical ruling by the state Supreme Court in New Jersey. The other is declaring shaken baby syndrome akin to junk science.
Yeah.
And I discussed my case of Michelle Healy earlier this year, and listeners, you can expect an update in that case in the next month or two.
Good news.
All right, so shifting then from the science to the alibis, we have episode 8 of The State versus Patricia Roar. And Rabia, this is your conversation with Tammy Mullen, her book, Convenient Suspect, about Patty Roar. And as she noted in the episode, I came in thinking she's guilty, and my reporting led me to believe that she was innocent and wrongfully convicted. So Rabia, at what point in your investigation into this case did you first speak to Tammy Mullen?
I spoke to Tammy pretty much right off the bat. I think that this was one of the cases that the Innocence Clinic at Georgetown University had kind of presented as an option for us to take a look at. It was one of the cases they had worked on and said, like, you know, and they gave us a bunch of different ones. And this one really caught my eye. And I said, I wanted to speak to Tammy because it seemed like Tammy is one of the advocates who has been in this for a very long time. We're going to be talking about another one of those advocates in episode 10, I believe. But, you know, it was important for me. And it was also important then to hear the story that, you know, she didn't go into this thinking, I'm going to be a hero for Patty. She's like, you know, I'm a crime writer. This is, you know, a fascinating story in my backyard. I want to write a book. Let's see if she cooperates. And what she encountered was not what she expected at all.
Yeah. And the question I had, and listeners might have as well, is there anything that didn't make the episode about your conversation with Tammy that you think listeners might find interesting?
I mean, there's so much. There's just so much cutting floor stuff. We're talking about, I don't know. I mean, it feels like tens of thousands of pages with the documents and hundreds of documents that are source documents for this. But you know, on the alibi issue, you know, I couldn't quite figure out like how to structure where I wanted to put it in the season, but I wanted to kind of put people in this chronologically in the minds of the investigators at the time. Because when I first looked at this and I thought, well, she's got all these alibis, how are the police like, oh, we're still going to go forward, right, with this prosecution? It was really hard to understand until you realize that one by one, they themselves undermine the alibis or they dismiss them. They rendered the alibis ineffective by not nailing them down early enough and not corroborating them. Each one of these alibis independently could have been corroborated independently as well, right? Yeah. Like if somebody said, I was at the bar or I was at the Cowboys Club, well, that person, you know, could have, like her boyfriend or his friend, they could have pointed to other people they could have gone and talked, spoken to. I mean, it was just... Yeah. An astounding, but almost deliberate. I feel like it was kind of deliberate to make sure that there was kind of nothing left standing for Patty. I don't even remember what your question was, but I hope that was the answer to it. Oh, what was left? Yeah, there's more. And by the way, for those folks who really want to dive deeper, I do suggest you look at the book. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And Rabia, that's the very first thing I wanted to address, is the state's attempt to undermine Patty's alibis. And I want to start not on the 15th, the day that Joe disappears, but the 16th, because we have Patty's neighbor, Tina.
Yeah.
And to set for the stage for this, I want to go back to, I think, episode 2. This is the one thing I'm pretty confident about, and I think you are too. I want to make sure. Joe's car... not in McCarty's parking lot by her house at 7 p.m. when Jan and his girlfriend Sandra go by, they leave McCarty's. It is there by 11:20 p.m. when the Schulers arrive for their late night visit. Is that something where you're pretty confident about that time frame?
We're confident about it. Yeah. The question is, was the state confident about it? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think this was another one of those things that they were happy to fudge and not pay too much attention to.
Yeah. Let's assume for a moment that we are confident in that timeline, which means that if Patty did this, she has to, after 7 p.m., park the car in McCarty's, get back to her own vehicle, and drive back down to North Carolina. Right. It's about a 9-hour drive.
Oh, right. And by the way, the state did a test run. It came out to 10 hours, in fact.
And that's a point I wanted to focus on, Rabia, as well, which is to say there is no deadline for Patty to get back on the morning of the 16th, right? She has every incentive not, if she commits this crime, not to speed back down to North Carolina. If she's pulled over, it's game over, right? So she's not speeding. The 10-hour drive test makes a lot of sense, right?
And frankly, her vehicles just were not even in any shape for her to be speeding. But certainly, yeah. What was her rush? What did she have to rush back to? Nothing, you're right.
Right.
Yeah.
When you buy LG, you get so much more than just an appliance. You get more done, more cost savings, more peace of mind, and more control. Because LG appliances are designed to do more. Like washers and dryers with AI tech to take out the guesswork, refrigerators that fit in tight spaces and keep food fresher longer, or ranges with precise induction cooking and easy cleanup built in, all with the style you want. And reliability you can count on, so you can get more from your home every day. LG appliances, so much more. Make life easier with LG. See the latest models and savings now at LG.com.
Takes us to Tina, the neighbor, mm-hmm. right? Yep. Because Tina says, 5:30 a.m.,
yep.
I saw Patty, I'm her neighbor, at her house, and she tells me, my mom got this call, my ex, about the wife and the kid disappearing. That's 5:30 a.m.
Yeah, 5:30 a.m., I think she doesn't see her, she gets a call from Patty.
Okay.
She had seen her the day before. On the 15th, Patty says that after she had all those, right. you know,
yeah.
that late afternoon, she saw Tina. She's getting her mail. She's like, I'm going to Cowboys tonight. And the next morning, 5:30 a.m., because Patty couldn't sleep after she got her phone call, phone call from her mom. Then she calls her neighbor.
If we go by the state's drive test of 10 hours and we say that Joe's car is not in the McCarty's parking lot by 7 p.m., that makes this impossible.
Yeah.
There's no way she's home and calling Tina at 5:30 a.m. because 10 hours from 8 p.m. is 6 a.m.
Yeah.
Half an hour after. And that's still, you know, there has to be time for her to get from parking the car in McCarty's to her own vehicle to drive home.
Yeah, we don't even know where her vehicle would have been in that neighborhood. And if people are searching the neighborhood, I mean, Andy, I'm assuming, he said he was searching the neighborhood. He didn't come across it. Look, here's the thing. The state was very effective in making sure they did not nail down things they didn't want to nail down.
Right.
Including this phone call and when it actually took place. Time and time again, what they did was, and you know, episode 9, we get into kind of what goes down at trial. I do not give it a witness by witness treatment. In fact, because there's just stuff that's more important to focus on. I kind of say basically what the state did was, because they could say, how do you know it was that day? Everyone had her alibi witnesses. How do you know it was? I mean, you weren't asked for 7 months. Well, they have, because you didn't ask. And even with Tina was not ever able to say, because she was asked so much later, that it was definitely the morning of the 16th. She said, I remember a 5:30 a.m. call. I remember Patty telling me about this incident where her ex's wife and child are missing. I don't know if it was that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That then takes me to the Cowboys alibi. This is where Patty would take her dance class. And you go through the various witnesses with Tammy Ma. We have Pete Jarrett, the dance instructor. We have Lisa Evans. We have Brian Ward, the boyfriend of Patty. And then we have Eric, this sort of new friend of Brian at the time of the crime. And you note with Tammy, his brother had showed up at the club and Eric had to sign in for him. And in fact, that is reflected on the timesheet on the 15th, the sign-in sheet, right?
Yes, yep. Mm-hmm.
Has anyone ever tracked down or talked to Eric's brother? Was he spoken to as part of the investigation?
No, nope, not at all.
Do we know if he's still out there in the wind and maybe
could
provide us? Because if he saw Patty, was that the only night that he went, as far as we know?
I don't know. I have no information. I think it's a great thing to think about and talk about. I just wonder about the value of it all these years later. Again, it was one of those things where the police could have easily, the FBI was on this. We're not talking about a bunch of, you know, amateurs here. They could have corroborated each one of these alibis with so many other alibi witnesses, and they just didn't do it. And by the time defense counsel got a hold of it, I mean, it was a lot later as well. A lot of time had gone by since December 15th, because she wasn't arrested for like 2 years, right? But they also didn't nail it down. And you know, I think in the episode, Tammy talks a little bit about how it seemed defense was really unprepared for this trial.
Yeah. And that then takes me to, we had a listener question on this, and you sort of had this in the end of your interview with Tammy. And I wondered, and this listener wonders whether it was brought up at trial. And that is this whole business about the phone line that Andy gets in Patty's name. Can you sort of re-explain that to the listener, set up the listener question?
Yeah. So this is a question by Amy Henderson, right?
Yeah. So Amy, I can read the question. You can sort of go into it.
Sure.
Was the fact that Andy literally stole Patty's identity to open a phone line in his home ever brought up in trial? The fact that he did this is wild, and the fact that it was still in her name when the disappearance happened is even more bizarre.
I do not recall. It's been a bit since I've read his testimony, but I do not recall it ever being brought up. And I'm assuming, if we're talking about defense counsel that are not well prepared, that this might be a detail that they didn't know. And maybe even Patty at the time didn't know. I feel like this is something that didn't come out till later. I can't remember exactly. Actually, this actually should have come out at that time, because the records were disclosed to defense, the home records, phone records, and they had Patty's name on them. I just don't know if they caught that or if they even thought it was relevant. I don't remember them being brought up at trial at all. I mean, what do you think would have been, do you think it would have been, I don't know, valuable? I mean, like meaningful to the jury in any way or could have swayed them in any way?
I think a lot depends on whether Andy would have a reasonable explanation for it. Right.
Well, there was none.
There was none. Other than, as far as we know. So evidence law, this is rule of evidence 608B. You're allowed to present evidence of subterfuge or dishonesty to call into question the veracity and the honesty of a witness.
Right. I mean, look, Patty didn't know. It would have been a he said, she said probably issue where he said, well, I asked Patty and Patty's like, I had no idea. We know why he did it. It was because he had no credit to speak of. He had no bank statements. He worked completely on cash. His father had to bail him out over and over. I mean, we're going to get into this in I think episode 10, about the many ways that Andy financially hurt Patricia during their relationship.
Right. And in terms of finances, this is an interesting question. It's something we brought up in our own series, such as the Pam Lanier case, where a huge motive presented at trial was you killed your spouse because of life insurance. And so Meredith Tavares asks, so odd, do we know if Andy profited from her death by life insurance money? Do we know if Joe had a life insurance policy on herself?
There was no life insurance policy. The police looked, it was like one of the first things they looked into. I didn't find anything.
Got it. So no financial motive that the defense could have presented.
No, there had been, they had been, I think, in communication with an agent, but they had never actually purchased the policy.
Yeah. And then sticking to the topic of motive, another question is from Brittany McCullough. She says, based on what I've heard so far, Andy seems like the perp, but I can't reconcile the motive. If he didn't know for sure whether baby Alex was his, why harm him to or leave him to the elements to die? In the last episode, I believe Rabia stated there was no paternity test performed. It was Andy or Joe having an affair at the time of the murders. I'll let you address it first. I have my own thoughts, Rabia, on this.
Okay, I'll go backwards. We have no evidence to suggest that Joe was having an affair at the time of murders. If she was, we have no idea. Or even any time during their marriage. Was Andy having an affair? We also don't know for sure. Is it weird that Terry Bonchini was around at their house immediately, like in their home days after the murder, and then he goes on to marry her? This is a woman that he had been dating on and off before Joanne. Yeah, it's weird. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they were, I mean, this is not uncommon. You know, somebody becomes widowed and they end up like with somebody who's like a friend of the family or somebody close. I mean, that we've seen that happen before. But so we don't know for sure. Having said that, that's correct. There was no paternity test performed. There was a semen sample was taken, you know, and I have never seen the results of like the testing of that, of the sperm of, you know, Andy's whatever, like, you know, the fertility. We just know that it was taken. And one of the officers, one of the detectives on the case said, yeah, he's fine. And that's like all we have. In terms of the motive here, I mean, this is what the profilers have said who've looked at this. They said that, you know, it just seems like the baby was collateral damage. There doesn't necessarily need to be a motive to kill the baby. And anyway, what are your thoughts, Colin?
Well, my main thought, and there was a interesting conversation on our Facebook page, is I believe Walter Trautman. I think he reported this the same day he saw it. He had no reason to know about any paternity issues.
Right.
And he said, what do you mean it's not mine? Is what the man said, the man he identified as Andy. And so, however it came about, I believe that was what Walter Trautman saw.
On Trautman, I'm only a little bit confused because of the color of the cars that he says, like the Andy's gray car. I don't know what gray car that would have been necessarily. Like, that's the only thing that kind of throws me off. Otherwise, he has said from the beginning, he saw the pictures. He didn't know these people. He didn't know the story. He's like, that's them. That's who I saw. I mean, I do think, I will say this, he reported it that day. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then later, Joe was reported missing. But he does not reappear in the investigation until the funeral happens. And he sees Andy's, either a picture of Andy or Andy on TV. I think it was in the newspaper, like at the funeral. And he's like, that's the guy I saw. And that was the woman I saw. In the meantime, between those that incidents and the funeral, I don't think he ever showed up to police and said that this woman who's been missing, who was missing for months before the bodies were found, I saw her that day. Mm-hmm. So that's what kind of like makes me wonder. It's like, there's no way the media was all over this and the news was everywhere. The hunt to find Joe and the baby was constant. Her pictures were in all the papers. They were in a TV report. So I just wonder why he didn't show up sooner to say, I saw her.
Yeah. In terms of the car color, whoever committed this crime, they of course could have been driven there by someone else.
Sure.
And might even prefer not to be driving their own car to
sure.
the scene of the abduction. So that's my thought on that. Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the other thing. Mm-hmm. So then how does that square with what I believe, well, it's a theory that I land on, is that Joe kind of voluntarily went to the woods because she thought something was going down. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, Colin, I guess is what I'm saying, you know? Or maybe they had the fight there. Then he's like, okay, forget it. We make up. Let's go buy a Christmas tree. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, obviously, one big issue, as you just highlighted, Rabia, is the lack of documentation for Walter Trautman.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
takes us to maybe the most troubling part of this whole investigation that you discussed with Tammy Mull, and that is Fonda Eggers, the distant relative of Tammy's.
Yeah.
And so, again, this is sort of this neighborhood watch where they're doing surveillance on Patty's home in the period of time covering the murder of Joe. And I just want you to clarify for the listeners, Kathy Penrose says, in today's episode, Rabia said the surveillance notes definitely exist, but I didn't catch why we're sure of that. And so you sort of reported, we know that Fonda Eggers gave notes to the authorities, but they're gone. Can you sort of state with some clarity what we know and don't know about those notes?
All right. Eggers had it out for Patty. Okay. On the day that Patty was sentenced or had that hearing, December 12th, Eggers was there. Eggers was a reporting officer. She'd been investigating her. What she wanted was for Patty to get arrested, for her to be forced to like not be allowed to keep animals anymore, which would have forced her out of the county. She wanted her out of the county. She didn't want her living there anymore. She didn't want her near her husband. She just hated her. So, but none of that happened. Instead, the judge was like, okay, Eggers, you got to stop harassing Patty. And I'm not going to take her horses away. I'm not going to arrest. And we're not going to do anything that would really make Patty say, I'm going to get up and leave this county. Instead, he said, Patty just needs to show that she's buying grain. Okay. And keep the receipts and produce them when requested. That same day after the hearing, Eggers goes and meets with some other locals. And we have one name. We don't know who the others might have been in this little posse. And is like, she needs to come up with a plan. She's not done. She was told to stop harassing Patty, but she's not done. And so she admits that her and a group of other neighbors were like, we think she's been stealing horses. Now, this is a different allegation than what she was actually investigating, which was animal abuse and neglect. And so they start surveying her. She says that during those 4 days, December 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 5 days, that they were at the house 3 to 5 times at least, maybe longer. Different people were there at different times a day. But she took notes of who was there and when they were there and what they saw. And those notes were turned over to the police. Now, I am positive she took notes because she is trying to make a case against Patty. She cannot make that case unless she's got some documentation. She's trying to create a record here. Okay. She says it during an interview later. She was interviewed by the police and I'm assuming she turned it over to them because that's what she said she did.
There was another question. I didn't post it, so I'm not sure who the listener was, but thank you. Asking, has anyone spoken to Fonda recently? Has she had a change in heart and maybe thinks this is wrongful conviction? Has anyone talked to her to see what she says today?
No, she has not been spoken to in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, at the end of the day, whether or not she thinks the wrongful conviction to me is kind of irrelevant. What I want to know is, I mean, if I could ask one question, right? It's
right.
Like, Did you see Patty every day that week? That's all. That's the only question that needs to be asked of her. Did you see Patty every single day that right. week? And if she says yes, I feel like that's the end of it. You know what I mean? Now, could within a 24-hour period? Yeah, maybe. But if she has seen Patty on the evening of the 15th because she was surveying her, and then the next morning, you know, I mean, then it would have been done because Joe disappears right. after 1 p.m., right? So anyhow, yeah, if anybody saw Patty that day on December 15th in North Carolina, it's kind of over.
Yeah. And then beyond that, you know, there's sort of destroying a pillar of the state's case. There's also death by a thousand cuts, which
right.
we hear this narrative that I've seen reported on Reddit and across the internet. And you discussed it with Tammy Mao of these long distance phone calls made up to the 11th. And then this gap in days where there's no long distance phone calls, which includes the 12th, when we know Patty was in North Carolina for her hearing. But right, Rabia, even if Fonda were to say, I remember she was there the 13th or the 14th.
Right.
Well, not a complete alibi. It would at least refute this narrative of she's out of town. She's not making long distance phone calls.
Yeah. And, you know, the prosecution went back and forth on what their actual theory was. You know, I think during closing, the prosecutor said, argued both that Patty had been in Pennsylvania for a number of days, like she got hung up on and she just took off, and that she was there, like that she actually made that phone call from Pennsylvania. And so it's like, it's, they don't have a sound theory, and it kind of seems like they didn't need to.
Yeah. And then we have another thing at the heart of the case, which is these competing narratives. Mm-hmm. The state very much wants to sell the narrative to the jury
right.
that Patty is jilted and jealous. And when Joe is mean with her on the phone, she drives up immediately to kill her, which obviously is false based upon the timing of the calls. With Tammy, though, you discussed at the top of the episode a new detail for our listeners, which is that some of Joe's friends say she found photos of Patty, I think in the basement of their home. Is that right?
In a closet somewhere, yeah.
In a closet. Can you share some more detail? Or is that coming up later? Can you share some details?
No, we're not going to, we're not bringing that up again. But yeah, they're apparently Joe had gotten into a fight with Andy, and she told some friends about it, that she had found a box that had letters from Patty and some pictures, the old pictures that he still had of her, and some cards and stuff. And he was like, listen, I don't even know it was there. That was his response. He's like, it was somewhere buried in the back of a closet. Of course, I mean, that could be completely true. I can totally see somebody doing that and forgetting that they've read it.
I couldn't.
No, you couldn't? No?
I might be generalizing. A guy is not holding on to photos and correspondence from a longtime ex-girlfriend unless he knows. Like, that's not accidental.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
That's very much intentional.
Actually, yeah. I guess what it is like, I've got like, you know, I've got pictures of my ex-husbands like floating around here and there. And the only reason they're there is not because I'm holding on to them. It's because I haven't taken the time to get rid of them.
But you know they're there. Oh, even though it's not, you're not holding, but you know they're there.
Yeah, I know they're there. Yeah. And there was actually another friend of Patricia's. I don't think we brought her up, who, when she was interviewed, said that Andy is the one who wanted Patty back. It seemed like he was the one who always wanted. Remember what Tammy said? When Andy got this phone number, like in Patty's name, phone line, Patty doesn't know he even has it. Patty doesn't have his number. Patty doesn't know he has a number. She's communicating through mail. So he has to call her and say, this is my number, right? So he is the one who made that that connection initially.
From the issue of this narrative back to the alibi, going full circle, Joan Qualls asks, would you please clarify which police were investigating in North Carolina who didn't look into Patricia's alibis? Were they from Pennsylvania or North Carolina? The trial was in Pennsylvania, correct? My question, Robbie, is how much communication and cooperation was there between the Pennsylvania police and the North Carolina police in this case?
Yeah, they were fully cooperating. So you had the FBI, and then you had, but the lead investigators were the Pennsylvania State Police. Mm-hmm. And then Davidson County, North Carolina Sheriff's Department was cooperating. And One of the detectives, Robeson, was a Davidson County detective who was working on it locally. But in many cases, you'll see this in the police reports where there's like a Pennsylvania State Trooper and Detective Robeson are both together, like working, like, you know, working through different witnesses. And they're both present at you know, interview and interrogation. So,
yeah. And then sticking with the alibi again, this cowboy's alibi, the dance club. As you note in your conversation, this is the day where, again, Brian, the boyfriend, and Eric, the friend, they say that Patty's having an issue with her van, and there's a spark when they open it. Do we know, did Patty ever take that van in for servicing in December?
So there's no evidence to show that she had any servicing done for that particular issue with the van, whatever the heating or electrical, whatever it was they smelled, that wasn't, or sparked, that wasn't working. But the van had other issues, and it was, and look, this is car talk. I don't know what it was. It was some part that needs to be changed in the van. And there's a receipt showing that she bought that part on the 10th. The 10th is the Saturday prior. And she bought the part. Her stepfather testified that on the 11th, Patty was like, "Can you fix this? I brought the part. Can you fix it?" And he's like, "I can't do it this weekend." And because he was busy, he couldn't do it. And then the 12th is when she had the hearing, right? So like, we know those days that she's definitely there. So we do have a receipt that she bought a part. And then her stepfather says, "Well, I just wasn't able to do it." But, and I can't remember when he says he actually did it. I think he said he did it the following weekend, which means the van that the state says, you know, she drove all the way to Pennsylvania and was something that was not really drivable because I think it was like an axle issue or something. Uh-huh. And if she drove over 35, it would shake and it was very unreliable.
Which speaks to not just the lack of feasibility of Patty doing this, but also how much of a risk that would have been, because even if somehow this van makes it up and back, she's risking that breaking down in this huge round trip, right?
Yeah. And she's pretty broke. She's pretty broke herself. She also apparently would be making this trip by herself because the murder for hire theory didn't work out. This was an era before cell phones. It's really risky. Yeah.
Yeah.
When it comes to the theory of the state saying that she was actually, because the reason we couldn't find any phone calls, you know, on her records, on the 12th was because she was in Pennsylvania making the call, right? Again, that presupposes she knew that Joe was going to hang up on her and mistreat her. And then she was going to kill her. and Joe could have just picked up the phone, but like she did the first time they talked and be like, "Oh yeah, all's good. Andy's here, you know, and the baby's fine. And why don't you come over?" I mean, you know, the conversation could have gone anyway, but also then you have to ask the question, then where was she for those days? 12, 13, 14, like, where, let's say after the hearing, she takes off that evening. She has to get from the hearing to Pennsylvania to make the phone call then, right? Like she has to make that 10-hour trip, first of all, before she can make a 9 p.m. phone call. Like none of it adds up. And then where does she stay for those days in the cold in December?
Yeah. And then sticking with that cowboy's alibi and the question you raised earlier, Rabia, about the efforts or lack thereof of defense counsel. Vitality 08 says, another thing about the sign-in sheet. If they think she orchestrated all the other things for a fake alibi, how likely is it that she would forget a major one, namely signing in or having someone sign in on her behalf? And so, Rabia, in the discussion with Tammy, you mentioned the timing of opening the general business for business versus the dance class, and many people saying they often didn't sign in or used fake names. Did the defense call those witnesses at trial, or is that just something that we know about separate from the trial?
No, the defense called the boyfriend, who was then the fiance and the father of her child, at trial, and also his friend. They did call them. But they were pretty effectively cross-examined, I think, because the state completely undermined their motive for being there. Oh, you're the father of her child, and oh, that's your best friend, you know, number one. And number two, how do you know it was that day, right? Uh-huh. But I do agree that, look, there's no dispute. The state does not dispute that Patty was in back in North Carolina by the 16th.
Right. So, at some point the 16th.
Right. Yeah. Well, she made a phone call, 9 a.m., right, which is a long distance phone call. That is on her phone records. We don't have the 5:30 a.m. call because it's a local call. It's next door. But there is like a 9:30 or 9:10, something like that, 9 a.m. phone call. So she's definitely home by then. She signed in on the 16th at Cowboys. When she signed in the 16th, she could have just flipped the page and been like, "I'm going to sign in on the 15th too." I mean, like, yeah, it seems like it would have been very easy for her to do that.
again, getting to the question of, we have a timestamp where Patty is definitely in North Carolina,
right,
meaning
9 a.m.
She would have to leave Pennsylvania, I guess around 11 p.m. would be the absolute latest, if we're using that as the
the
point where she's definitely in
North parks Carolina. The car and she just takes off. This woman doesn't have to use a bathroom or restaurant. I mean, like, she doesn't buy any food the whole time because there's no witnesses. I mean, come on. Anyway.
Do we know, by the way, in terms of the jurors, has anyone spoken to the jurors and seen what they thought about the alibi or the evidence? Or do we know what the jurors' thoughts were about the evidence at trial?
I mean, what we know of some of the jurors' thoughts, actually, I am reporting in episode 9, many of them were very, very comfortable. And actually, yeah, let's wait till episode 9. I'm going to talk about that.
Okay, great. So your listeners, setting up episode 9, our next episode, we'll have some insights into the jury.
Yeah.
And then the last thing, Rabia, in terms of the narrative the prosecution tried to weave at trial, this is something I've seen online as well, especially in Reddit forums. And you discuss it with Tammy. This is the hair salon receipt. And the police claiming, this is Patty, forging an alibi for the date that Joe disappears. Mm. But again, just to reiterate from the episode, Patty never claimed this is an alibi, right?
She actually never did, which I thought was interesting. And it made me wonder, and I'm going to ask her, because I did ask Tammy, has anybody ever asked her? She actually never brings it up. So, you know, if it was something she was trying to, you know, contrive as an alibi, then why didn't she actually point to it?
Right. All right. That leaves us then with the SpeakPipe messages. And so, Rabia, if you want to set it up, we can go through those messages.
So we have a lot of messages from Amy, and I'm not going to play them all. I'll play the first one, but then I will try to address, Amy, your questions going throughout I think there's a 4 messages, 4 or 5 in here.
Hi, this is Amy Henderson again. Just calling in with some questions and thoughts about Andy and the move to Colorado. I know that he and Joanne were looking at places in Colorado, were both excited to move out there, had talked a lot about it. But it sounded like in the weeks leading up to her disappearance, she had told her friends at lunch and some other folks that they were going to hold off a little bit, wait until the baby was a little bit older. And when I was listening to Tammy Mal's book, she mentioned the fact that she spoke to their realtor out there, and their realtor had been telling them about a property that fit, you know, kind of ticked all their boxes, for sale by owner. The owner agreed to take on the mortgage, which was necessary because of Andy's poor credit, but that Joanne had ultimately said no, that they were going to pass on it, that, you know, they were going to wait a little bit and kind of delaying things, and the realtor sort of push back with some encouragement and saying that, you know, this is a kind of a rare find, and it was, and gave her, you know, an ultimate deadline of the date, allegedly, that she went missing, you know, for their final decision. And, you know, Joanne had said no, and I guess she called Joanne again one more time, just really not wanting them to miss it, but Joanne again said no. And to me, it just strikes me as too much of a coincidence that she would go missing on that day, and then Andy would move to Colorado less than 6 months later and not even tell the police what his address was there.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and play Amy's second message, and then I'm not going to play the other 6, but I'm going to respond to some of the stuff in it.
Hi, Amy Henderson with part 2 about my Colorado thoughts. So in the book, they say that he had moved out there and that the police were trying to get in touch with him. I believe it was not that long after they found the bodies, and that they were looking for his address, but they had to get it from his mom, and his mom was kind of a little dodgy about giving it to them and saying, you know, that like he wanted to protect his privacy, which I can understand, but also still strikes me as strange that you would move, you know, after the disappearance and murder of your wife and baby and not let the authorities know where you were going. And it struck me as odd that all of a sudden he would have had the ability to just go and buy a property out there so quickly when it seemed like it was going to be very hard for them because of his financial position. Just not really sure what to make of that. And, you know, I know that Joanne had told some people, according to the book, that she was, you know, feeling isolated, a bit overwhelmed, which is all normal for postpartum. But I imagine that moving out there to a rural area would be even more isolating. And I'm wondering if they were fighting about that leading up to the disappearance, and if that had something to do with it, if that was a catalyst in some way.
All right, so I'm going to stop there. Amy is reading Tammy Mao's book. And again, I also highly recommend it if you want a lot more details that we kind of can't get into in the podcast. And Amy is talking about the fact that they were supposed to be moving out to Colorado. They're going to make a decision on a property on the day she disappeared, in fact. Or I believe they had up until that day or something. But it was not an easy mission for the realtor, because the realtor had to find somebody who was willing to, as an owner of property, owner finance it. You know, Andy just didn't have the credit. He didn't even have a bank account. So, you know, he didn't have any reportable income. So how are you going to get approved for a home loan? But see, here's the thing. Andy wanted to move to Colorado before he met Joe. This was like a kind of a very long dream of his. And I think probably what happened was, like, you know, Joe was excited about it as well. And, you know, but with the baby coming, there might be financial reasons. Maybe she wants to be closer to her family because, you know, her family can come and go and they helped her take care of the baby. Could that have been a motive for them to be fighting? Maybe. I don't know. I mean, like, it could have been that combined with paternity issues. But I also wonder about Andy. You know, when men are under tremendous financial pressure, right? Like, does Joe even know about his situation is what I wonder. Because I have seen situations like this in real life where, like, after decades of marriage, women are like, wait, our whole life was like a life of cards. Like, you know what I mean? You actually never had any money. So it could be that maybe he finally had to come clean and say, by the way, I actually can't buy anything. I have no money. I have no credit. I'm not going to get a loan. I don't know. But maybe his dad was going to help him do it. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, Robbie, what I wanted to ask was, going back to Joe's friend saying she had found the photos of Patty and the communication, do we know when that was? Do we have a timestamp?
I don't. I actually don't. But, you know, they'd only been married. They haven't been married that long. So it was in the previous year, likely.
Well, I'm just sort of putting the pieces together, which is to say, imagine it is November or December. And that is when Joe finds the photos in the communications.
Mm.
Then Patty calls.
Yeah.
That explains why Joe is so upset when she calls.
She's triggered. Yeah.
And B, you can only imagine the aftermath of that phone call. Wait, I just found your ex's photos and communications in a closet, and now she's calling, and I yell. Like, that's not going to go too smoothly between Joe and Andy at that point. So, I mean, that's just sort of putting some pieces together.
No, for sure. And, you know, when Andy talks about that night, he's telling everybody, oh, we just kind of laughed about it, and it was done.
No.
I don't think so either.
When Joe is giving the third degree to Patty, she doesn't get off the phone and then calmly laugh.
And laugh about it. Yeah.
I don't see that happening.
Yeah. It seems like she was
not. It's not my understanding of human nature.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And that might explain why between that first time she talked to her, you know, and this time, like, there's this big difference. It could be that she just found all the stuff. Okay. This is also interesting. In, I think, Amy's fourth message, she says that there is a show on Stars called The Wrong Man. And they do, I think, one or two episodes on this case. And in it, the investigators working on it, they go to speak to Andy. He doesn't agree to be on camera, but one of the things he says to him is that, you know, when she disappeared, you know, we had this perfect life, Camelot, all that, but, you know, we were just about to move to Colorado. Like, we were literally going to move like a week later. He tells him that. And that's as Amy says, a blatant lie. That was a lie. And I don't know why he would say that unless he's just, it's been so many years. It's kind of all coming, you know what I mean? Like, kind of, you know, getting confused in his mind, because that can happen as well. I don't know. Let's see what else. All right, I'm going to play this message now by Ben.
Hey, my name's Ben. I'm from the UK, long-time listener of the show. I just had a couple of questions. The first of all was in last week's addendum, you were talking about the troopers' theory that the gun jammed and so they had to bludgeon them. From my interpretation, what he was saying is he would have tried to shoot her first to kill her, then the gun jammed, then he bludgeoned her, and then he shot her afterwards, you know, after the gun had been jammed or whatever. So I was just, whereas you were talking about kind of shooting her in the face, then bludgeoning her because the gun jammed. So I was just curious as to why that's your theory or your interpretation of what he was saying, because I kind of saw it the other way around. And it does kind of make sense as a possible theory. I'm not saying it did happen that way, but it makes more sense the way I described it, I think. The second question I was going to ask is the timeline, which you haven't gone into huge detail with yet, and I'm sure you will do. And it's always the best part of the undisclosed scenes, in my opinion. But I'm just wondering, the day of the 15th of December when they went missing, was there enough time for Andy to finish work, get home, drive them out there, commit the murders, get back before making those phone calls to the police and to his parents and, you know, all that stuff? And obviously we don't know if a lot of them took place, apart from we know that the call to the police took place. I was just wondering if that's a possibility, or whether you think it would have had to have been done in the day, because the other theory is that it happened the night before, because no one had seen Joe before then, apart from this strange phone call with the mother-in-law, which seems to me to be made up, if I'm being honest. There's no evidence it happened. But the problem with that theory, of course, is that leaving the baby alive at that point is very, very risky, because if they get found before, you know, you've had the chance to make this phone call and do all this stuff, you know.
Okay. So Ben is making a great point, and I agree that you're probably right in terms of your interpretation and what Coach Javar was saying, that he thinks if the gun jammed, then maybe the perp was like, I got to beat her to death, mm-hmm. and then maybe tried to fire a second time. Perhaps, yeah. What do you think about that, Colin?
Was the medical examiner able to determine whether the head wounds, other than the gunshot wound, were post-mortem or anti-mortem, before death or after death?
They were before death. They were bleeding.
Okay. They were bleeding. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so it's a possibility. Yeah. I mean, it's a fair point. Absolutely.
It's a possibility, yeah. The one thing I do wonder about, though, is the only gun that Patty's been connected to is this gun that her ex, Walter Blylock, says she bought, you know, this junky little thing at a yard sale. And it was a fit in the palm of her hand little Jennings. And I just wonder if a gun that small and light could have done that kind of damage. I don't know. Anybody who might own one or knows enough about guns, reach out and let us know. Because the injuries to Joe were pretty significant, if they were committed by a gun, a butt of a gun. I mean, there could have been a whole other weapon involved. We just don't know. The second question is, okay, is there enough time? Yeah. I mean, like, even if Andy never left the work site, let's say he never left until he says he did, was 5:30. He's home by 6. If he's like, let's head out, Joe, and do some whatever they're going to do, it's like a 20-25 minute drive from their home. And, you know, the folks that I've talked to are like, this whole thing didn't go, it didn't take more than like 5-6 minutes for the whole thing to go down. He's back in the car. He's home within 60 to 90 minutes. Easily it could be done. We will get a little more. Hopefully I can squeeze it into the remaining episodes, the timeline and where there might be gaps. You know, again, you have to keep remembering that Andy's alibis are his parents and to some extent the Hulschwanders. But we can be almost certain that the Hulschwanders are getting some things wrong. Unless Andy was thinking so far in advance that he managed to convince the Hulschwanders that the phone call had taken. Because at some point, Kathy Hulschwander, the wife in that family, tells the police that, yeah, that week, meaning the 13th, And he told us that the night before, Patty had called and like this whole thing, and we were laughing about it. She says that that happened on the 13th and that the call happened on the night that Andy told her. That call did not happen on the 12th. We know that for sure. But does that mean that by the 13th, Andy was already kind of getting his ducks in a row? Yeah, maybe.
I mean, it would be strange if Kathy has the same misunderstanding completely separate and apart from Andy's. It would seem that she's getting information from Andy.
Yeah, of course, yeah. All right, I think we're going to wrap it up there. We do have a couple more questions, but I'm going to hopefully save them for later. And I think that's it for addendum, what is this, 8?
All right. So listeners, you already heard from Rabia that we'll hear some about the jurors in episode 9. Mm-hmm. Anything else, Rabia, that listeners can expect?
For episode 9, yeah. We're going to get into what actually got Patty convicted.
All right. Well, thanks, listeners. As always, we will see you back next Monday for episode 9 of The State vs. Patricia Rohr.
Thank you so much, Colin. Thank you, guys. And if you want even more undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at undisclosedpod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at undisclosedpod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you gotta do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at EvidenceProf on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at UndisclosedPod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.
This episode is brought to you by Alloy Health. On Undisclosed, stories often show how hard it is to get the right help when you need it. Menopause can feel the same way. Almost half of women wait 3 or more years before finding relief from symptoms like hot flashes, sleepless nights, and brain fog. Many try to get answers from their doctor, only to be told it's normal or feel rushed through an appointment. Alloy was built by women who have been there. It connects you with menopause-specialized doctors and proven treatments, all from home. Care can start in hours, not weeks. Join the 95% of women who tried Alloy and saw relief in the first 2 weeks. Head to myalloy.com and use the code SUMMER20. Your menopause specialized doctor will tailor your treatment to your exact needs. Plus, you get unlimited messaging with your doctor. Head to myalloy.com and use code SUMMER20 to get $20 off.